Welcome to Podcast on the Brink, your weekly dose of Indiana basketball news and discussion, brought to you by the Assembly Call and Inside the Hall. I'm your host, Jared Morris. Join me live at assemblycall.com every Thursday night and immediately following every IU game for our live IU postgame show. And visit insidethehall.com for complete coverage of IU basketball and to join the discussion in the Inside the Hall premium forum.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Podcast on the Brink, and we are pleased to be joined by one of our favorite recurring guests, Mike DeCourcy of the Sporting News, someone who I've been reading for a long time, write about college basketball, and he also writes about a variety of things for the Sporting News. Welcome back to Podcast on the Brink, Mike. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well, Alex. It's always a pleasure to join you.
So before we got on, I was reading your column that you wrote yesterday at the Sporting News, and you called yesterday the best day for college basketball, in quite a while. The fact that we now have a plan for the season, the NCAA has set a start date. What's your instant reaction to this plan? Do you think it's going to set the NCAA up for success? Do you like it? Do you have any problem with it? I'm just kind of curious for your overall thoughts on.
I think the first thing to realize is that it's more of a framework than it is a plan right now. What was presented yesterday was a series of dates, some guidelines, but there's still a lot to work out within those guidelines. And I found it interesting that in announcing that, the things that they control, such as the competition window, both from a practice standpoint and from a timing standpoint, they had answers to that. But they also control the postseason. That's where, obviously, they make their money. That's what everyone in college basketball points toward and gets excited about and wants to be involved and all of that. And they didn't make any announcements about that. They didn't give us any clarity about, okay, we're going to have a 68-team tournament, or we're going to have a bubble scenario for the regionals, or whatever they might possibly have said. They didn't say any of it. So there still are a lot of questions to be answered, not only from the individual conferences and member schools, but also, indeed, from the NCAA. What they told us was, look, we're going to hoop. And that was great news. And here's when we're going to hoop. We're gonna start practicing on October 14th. We're going to start competition on November 25th or 24th. And then now you guys go figure out how you're going to qualify for our tournament, which we still haven't said will be 68 teams. I'm not saying they left us with more questions than they should have, because I think that because of the nature of the virus and how things have constantly changed, generally for the better, but not exclusively for the better, that it's understandable that they don't want to commit to any particular postseason scenario at this point. But it does, like I said, leave us still with a question of what is everybody shooting for? And for those member schools and conferences, how will they do the shooting?
Do you think it's just implied at this point that they're going to attempt to go for the 68-team tournament? Because when the ACC coaches came out a couple weeks ago with their what I thought was ridiculous proposal to include every team, Dan Gavitt issued a statement saying that they're not looking at any scenarios to expand the tournament. So, is it more of, do you think at this point they're hoping to go business as usual, and then we'll address anything that changes down the line if we get to that point?
Yes, that's one of the reasons why they can't require anybody to do anything. They can say you have to play X number of games to qualify for our tournament, which they did, 13 games, if you want to have any chance to be involved. So they're not going to take your rec league champions are not getting in because they played the short intramural season. They're not getting in. You have to play 13 intercollegiate games to qualify for the tournament. So they can say that. But I don't think that they want to necessarily dictate at this point a scenario in which they're going to expand or contract. And they want teams to play interconference games because that gives them a better handle on how to select and seed the field. They can you and I can sit here and say the Big Ten's going to be really good this year, and you and I both know it's going to be really good this year. But how good? How good is established by what you do against outside competition? I mean, you can't just look at it as a beauty contest. This is basketball. You have to play people and beat them, and so that's why the NCAA said we need you. We would like you. We can't force you, but we would like you to play at least four interconference games. If you can do that, that'll help us out a lot. And I think that encouragement is also a little teeny bit of an implied threat. If you don't help us out, you know, I don't know that they'll necessarily be punitive, but it really makes their job hard. So they're really looking for the conferences to find a way to do this. And I think ESPN, in particular, from everybody that I've spoken to and things I've seen reported elsewhere, I think ESPN is doing their best for their own sake and for the sake of the game, I guess, to try to create a scenario where that can be done safely. They've talked to a lot of people about using the Orlando bubble that's already basically in place or some variation of it to contest the various tournaments they own all but simultaneously. And also the possibility of, you know, once, like they take the Advocare Classic, which used to be the Old Spice, played on Thanksgiving, eight teams in Orlando in the same venue that they're using for the NBA playoffs now, although it certainly looks different now. But in that same venue, they've had eight teams every Thanksgiving for the last decade or so, if not longer. And so they're going to have them down there, presumably. And then also they're plan, the plan they've discussed is to take, they have a tournament in Charleston, they have one in Myrtle Beach, I can't remember all the different ones they own, but basically to take a bunch of them down there, play those tournaments, and then also maybe get another game or two in for the teams that are there so that they can build a schedule that way, and they can, you know, you're basically at this point, since most people aren't going to be able to play before fans or a significant number of fans, they're basically trying to give the teams the opportunity to build a resume and for the conferences to build their what I always call the value of their currency. I've always compared that those intra-conference games the way you would, like a euro is worth this versus the dollar, and the dollar is worth this versus the peso. That's kind of the way I look at it. When you have the interconference games in November and December, when you get to January, a Big Ten win is worth this. Now, last year, a Big Ten win was worth basically a British pound. It was up above just about everything, and so that's what those interconference games, however they can be managed, however they can be constructed, will how they'll help the season develop and how they'll help conferences get teams into the NCAAs.
Given that the relationship between college basketball conferences and the NCAA is different than what we've seen in college football, where you have just kind of a free for all and, you know, the NCAA doesn't run the football playoff, but they do run the tournament. I'm curious, you know, over the next couple of weeks and maybe even months, the most fascinating thing to me is going to be to watch how different conferences approach scheduling. You know, the Big Ten has a lot of agreements with, you know, they have the ACC Challenge with the Big Ten. They have the Gavitt Games. Indiana is a little bit unique in that they play the Crossroads Classic every year. But then you also have some programs within the Big Ten, and I don't want to name any names, but have been known to schedule a lot of cupcake games to kind of pad their win total before going into conference. How do you think the Big Ten's going to manage the schools and kind of dictating what events they play in. For example, looking at Indiana, you know, if they were to play 27 games, which is the maximum allowed, and we assume there's 20 conference games, they could have between Maui, assuming that is played somewhere, the Gavitt games, the ACC Challenge and Crossroads Classic, that could be six games right off the bat there. So they could be playing a much more challenging schedule than, say, in Iowa. How do you think the Big Ten's going to, you know, be involved in terms of the scheduling for its conference teams?
Well, I think that the first thing, the football thing being relatively solved as of Wednesday, is a great advantage, a great assistance to those who care about Big Ten basketball. If that were still an unanswered question when the NCAA made its basketball announcement later in the day, that would have been problematic, because Big Ten football, solving that problem is a high priority. And as I said, having that resolved means it means the focus of the league, once they get a schedule together and all that for football, the focus of the league can be on planning for other sports as well. And there are different people assigned to different sports and all of that, but you're still calling Jim Phillips or Ward Manuel or Gene Smith. You're still calling all these people that have different, they have a lot of different concerns at the institutional level as well. So if you're calling Gene Smith about a basketball matter, he might be a little bit more willing to pick up the phone for a football question than a basketball question if the football deal isn't mostly resolved. So I think that from that standpoint, that there's an assistance there. I think that it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks to determine, can you play an ACC Big Ten Challenge? I mean, that's, you're talking about basically 13, 14 different sites, which is more challenging than what might happen with the Maui Invitational moving either to Carolina or to here in Indy, or what I've mentioned before about ESPN staging the various tournaments in the bubble, in the Orlando bubble. 14 different game sites for the ACC Big Ten Challenge that's an endeavor, and I'm not sure whether they're going to want to do that. Now, they could also create an ACC Big Ten bubble if they wanted and play a couple of games or three games against different teams in that bubble or in a couple of bubbles. So there's a lot of different questions to be answered there. And, you know, how much are different schools maybe going to rely on their regions? Indiana has a lot of very capable Division I schools in the region if they want to build a non-conference schedule, whether it be Cincinnati from the American or Louisville from the ACC or moving down to the Valley or the Horizon League. There are a lot that are within reach that you can bring to Bloomington to play in an empty or relatively empty gym and get some quality opposition that way. So there's a lot of questions to be answered, but now they all have a framework in which to answer it. They know when they can start. They know when they can start getting their team ready. There still are many, many questions to be answered, some of which there have received a lot of attention and work and planning, and some that may have developed as a result of yesterday's announcement.
Yeah, the reason I was so interested in your comments on that was, you know, thinking about a reduced non-conference schedule for college basketball, and if some of these schools are only going to play power, you know, five or six schools in their non-conference game, I'm curious to see how it might affect mid-majors and low majors, because they rely on that one opportunity oftentimes to prove themselves against an Indiana or an Ohio State. And if they're not getting that opportunity this year due to the reduced number of games, I'm just curious how that might impact their chances to make the tournament. Do you think that could be an issue?
I think one thing that maybe comes out of this that would be wonderfully beneficial for the mid-majors is to stop carping about who won't play you and start playing one another. you know, one of the big hindrances to mid-majors over the past decade or more has been the unwillingness to play one another. They know, just as we can sit here and say we think Iowa's going to be really good and Michigan State's going to be really good and Wisconsin's going to be really good and Illinois and Rutgers got a lot back and Indiana. So we know roughly who should be good. Well, it's true at the mid-major level too. I mean, I don't know exactly who might be who at this point, but I mean, a couple of years ago when Wofford was really good, everybody knew Wofford was going to be really good. They had everybody back from a really good team the year before. So whether they were going to be good enough to win every Southern Conference game and get in the tournament and win a game and all that, I mean, that all works itself out. But they knew they were going to be really good. And yet those teams struggle sometimes to get games against other mid-majors. I've always been frustrated by this. I look at it and I say, why won't you guys play one another? I know a year ago, Furman, which was bringing back a pretty capable team, made a lot of phone calls to other mid-majors because they knew that it was going to be hard for them to get in Duke's gym or whatever. But if they played a Belmont or somebody, and I'm not saying Belmont, but that kind of team, that would help them if they could either get the win or at least it would the loss to a high-quality opponent wouldn't hurt them. But it's hard for those teams to get games. Well, now's maybe the time to stop rejecting those phone calls and start trying to figure out a way to get on the court against one another and build up what would be quality wins. I mean, if you beat a team, let's say Belmont goes into the OVC this year and goes 16-0, and you're Furman, just to use the same example, and you beat them. I mean, that helps you. Whether it helps you as much as beating a 15-5 Wisconsin team in the Big Ten, maybe, maybe not, but it still helps you. And those teams have been just as studious about avoiding playing the good mid-majors as have the high majors. And they have less of an excuse because the high major can say, look, I don't need to play Furman because I've got Michigan State, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Purdue on my schedule. I don't need to play Furman. But the team from the Southland or the OVC or the Horizon or whatever league, they don't have that excuse. And yet they still dodge the call. So I say if the mid-majors are worried about building sufficient resumes in this particular season, now's the time to find out, you know, who really wants to get in by playing a high level opposition from your equivalent level.
One other thing, I don't exactly remember who I saw it from last night, but there was a story, it may have been on The Athletic, that discussed just kind of the tournament selection process for the upcoming season and how it may be different in terms of the metrics they use, depending on just the available data. You're playing less games, you have less to compare. Do you have a problem if in this season coming up, if there's more of an emphasis on just the committee using the eye test, if they don't have enough information to use maybe some of the metrics that we've been used to seeing used in the past?
You know, I'm not an eye test person. My standard line for probably two decades to this has always been that if we all had perfect eyes, we'd all live in Vegas in very big houses. So I don't trust anybody's eyes. I don't even really trust my own. I mean, I can have an idea of who I think is a really good team or who I think is a better team. But on a given day, I mean, I don't bet on sports. One, I'm not sure it's ethical in my position. But two, I want to keep my money, and it's hard to know who's going to win from day to day. So I'm very much a results-oriented person. Do I think you need to use some level of common sense? I absolutely. But if teams play 27 games, we're really not reducing it that much from standard. That's only four fewer games. Now, if we're not able to get to that, I certainly think that the committee has to be able to exercise common sense. And how one would judge common sense versus the eye test Maybe it's the same thing. Maybe it's not. To me, common sense would be more like, let's say the Big Ten has the strong season that we think they're going to have. And in a truncated non-conference, somebody like Rutgers, say, goes out and drops a couple of games that don't look good. But then they go into the league and they finish, let's say, a very strong fourth. But maybe their non-conference doesn't look as good as some others. But still, I mean, you're finishing fourth in a very strong league. Should you bypass that team? I would say that a good example of common sense not being exercised would be, I'm going to say it was around 2013, I think, 2012 or 2013, University of Washington won the Pac-12 regular season. They didn't get in. If you win a high major conference's regular season, you're a tournament team. That was common sense not being exercised. So you can allow the analytics to drive you a little too hard. Again, that wasn't the eye test. That was common sense. I don't remember what Washington looked like that year, who played for them. But I know that if you win the regular season of a high major league, you're a tournament team. So that's more what I would lean on than, somebody sitting in the room says, I watched them play and I thought they were really good. That doesn't mean much to me.
Yeah, that particular story, actually, I pulled it up now and it caught my eye because it said that Dan Gavitt mentioned that odds are the net will be obsolete for this season and the committee members will go old school back to their eyeballs. And that kind of concerned me from the standpoint of we've already had questions the last couple of years about the net. We don't know exactly how it's even formulated. And so going from a system that we already have question marks about with a net to something that could be really hard to understand and could be just left up to the judgment of people in a room other than going by the results, I think is at least something to think about and question as we approach the season. But on the other hand, I think we're all just happy to have basketball back and we'll deal with whatever the bracket looks like. And maybe it will be it won't be much different than any other year where we all have a couple teams when the bracket does come out that we're complaining and wondering why they got in.
Alex, I'll say this about that. I spoke to Dan, I think it was in July, about that. And at that point, there were questions about whether there would be a non-conference season. And those questions haven't been completely erased by the NCAA's guidelines yesterday, but they have been somewhat mitigated by that. They have, in saying that we'd like you to play for at least four non-conference games, they're kind of encouraging teams to try to be creative while still being safe. And the ESPN idea, I mean, the success of the bubble with the NBA, now it won't be quite the same for colleges because part of the reason the NBA's bubble was successful was that they basically quarantined in place for a couple of weeks before they even threw the ball in the air, and that won't happen at college level. But there is that idea that if you have the teams gathered in Orlando for non-conference tournament competition and then maybe some subsequent out-of-tournament competition, that you can build a resume. So the net might not be quite as effective, more or less, as it would be with no pandemic, no problems, everybody going everywhere they ordinarily want to go. I mean, that's what it was designed for. So it may be a little bit different than that ideal. But they also have other metrics they can use to sort of put them back on track, whether it's Ken Pom or Kevin Pauga's KPI or some of the others. They can sort of look to see if there are any serious outliers in what they're doing with the net. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not we see the number of non-conference games that have been promised or maybe not promised, but hinted at over the last several weeks. I think there will be non-conference competition. And then what will be interesting is the degree of conference competition. How many games? How will it be pulled off? Will leagues go into bubbles? I think there will be some of that. And I think that when the committee sits down in early March, I think they'll have a pretty good set of data to try to make the judgments that they typically make. It won't be the perfect set, but I think that it'll be a fairly comprehensive look at the season.
One thing we didn't see from the NCAA, and I'm not sure I expected to see it yesterday, was any recommendations on testing for COVID-19. I would expect that's going to be handled at the institution and conference levels. But how do you think that that could impact non-conference play and leagues like the Big Ten being willing to play schools from maybe lesser conferences if they don't have the same resources in terms of testing for the virus?
Yeah, I think that that's going to be a factor, no question. Because the Big Ten's promise to use daily testing for football, and then subsequently, I believe they said that will be available to all fall sport athletes if they're training or if they indeed engage in competition. I don't think they've made a final decision about that at this point, given that most of the fall championships have been moved to the spring. May not be as important to get the volleyball team or soccer team on the field or court at this point. But I think that it might be, they might be less willing to do something like that, to have in a team that they ordinarily would play, to play a single game at their home court. That's why I said, I think that a lot of the non-conference competition will be in these groups, whether it's ESPN's bubble or whether it's the Maui Invitational circumstance, wherever it winds up, the battle for Atlantis, which I believe is going to be in South Dakota now. I think a lot of the non-conference competition will occur in those, and I do think that there's a possibility that leagues will get together, maybe, as I said, maybe the ACC and Big Ten get together and have a challenge, but it's in a specific location or locations. It's not 14 teams playing in or 28 teams playing in 14 different spots. It's maybe 14 teams in two different spots and maybe playing more than one game. Believe me, I'm not saying that specifically is going to happen, but that sort of thing could happen involving a lot of different leagues.
I'll get you out of here on this, Mike. We've talked a lot about all of this uncertainty and what's still to be figured out for the upcoming season. But what we do know that you mentioned earlier in the show was that the Big Ten is going to be really good again this season. We were robbed of seeing a tournament last year where the Big Ten could have had 9, maybe 10 teams in the tournament. This year, I think we're looking at a similar scenario for the league. What are you most intrigued by heading into the season? I know you wrote about Luca Garza coming back to school in your column yesterday as one of the good pieces of good news that we have had this offseason in college basketball. But just the Big Ten at large, what are some of the storylines that you're going to be most interested in following when we do get basketball back?
Yeah, I think my final bracket for Fox last year had 10 Big Ten teams, if I recall correctly. And that would have been a pretty remarkable performance. I haven't done the math on this lately, so I don't remember. I think 10 out of 14 would not be the record. It would have been the record if they had gotten 10, because the Big East in 2011 had 11 of 16. So the Big Ten, if they'd gotten 10, would have been the most ever for in terms of percentage of membership in the NCAA. So I don't know that necessarily this year will be as deep. I'm not anticipating that. It's possible. That's not necessarily my feeling, but my feeling is that it's even stronger at the top this time and deeper at the top, if that, that's kind of contradictory, but the number of excellent teams runs deeper. Last year, I thought the number of Final Four contenders was somewhat limited, although the number of really good teams in the league was extraordinary. Even teams like Purdue and Minnesota that were not going to make it were exceptional, just were exceptional in the wrong neighborhood. I think that there will be at the top, you, like I mentioned before, Wisconsin brings back virtually everyone from the team that won the league. And when I say won the league, I'm talking about they were not a contender with Kobe King at the beginning of the season. They lost him and they became champions. He transferred out. They made some personnel changes in terms of the way they constructed their lineup. Some guys stepped forward. Micah Potter played more, and they became league champions. And that team is basically intact. Michigan State loses some very key players, obviously, Cassius Winston, Xavier Tillman, but still has an extraordinarily deep team, even without those guys. Iowa gets back Garza, so they now have the best offensive team in the league, if not the nation. Can they put together a defense that measures up to that offense? That's still a challenge. Illinois bringing back Io DeSumo, whose return was probably the most surprising of all the players who chose to play another year in college basketball. I thought Io was going to leave. Some people that I know that cover them kept saying that they got the feeling he didn't want to go, and maybe the news wasn't quite good enough at the NBA level to convince him to do something he didn't want to do. And so he's back, and I always thought Kofi Coburn would be back, but the two of them give Illinois a chance to develop an offense that matches up to their defense. And so I look at that group of teams, and I think that's just an amazing group. Any one of those teams could be in somebody's top 10, and I think as you see those roll out again – closer to the start of the season, I think you'll see any or all of those four teams in people's top tens. And then Rutgers is a pretty consistent team that people are kind of squeezing into toward the bottom of their top 25 because they know that they are dangerous. Indiana is a team that has great potential if they can figure out exactly how they want to play and how best to play. And I'm not questioning the coaching staff on that. I just think that adding Christian Lander makes it really significant difference in. I mean, they can't play the same way as they played last year with Christian in the lineup. He changes too much, so they have to find a comfortable method of playing. But if they do, he's really talented. A lot, Trace is terrific. They've got some really good veteran players there, and so. There's great potential there. I'm really excited about what that all might bring. It could be a really entertaining winter for those of us who love college basketball and who follow the Big Ten closely.
Mike, we always enjoy your insights. Thanks for taking the time to join us this week on Podcast on the Brink. Follow Mike on Twitter at TSN Mike. Read him on the Sporting News, and I'm sure he'll be making some appearances. I don't know if they'll be in person or virtually, but he's always on the Big Ten Network. We enjoy his insights there. Thanks again, Mike.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Podcast on the Brink. We always appreciate you being here. Remember to join me and my co-hosts for more IU basketball talk at assemblycall.com and visit Alex over at insidethehall.com for complete coverage of Indiana basketball. If you want to support Podcast on the Brink, here is the single best way to do it. Tell anyone you know who loves IU hoops about us and suggest that they subscribe. Podcast on the Brink can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else podcasts are available. Tell your social media followers, email your friends, text your family members. For weekly discussion about IU basketball, they need to be subscribed to Podcast on the Brink. We'll talk to you next time. Go Hoosiers.